You're listening to Thursday Night Tailgate with Chris Mascaro and Bob Lazzari, where NFL legends live on. Back to you, boys.
All right, now making his inaugural appearance with us here on Thursday Night Tailgate is former Panthers defensive back Rod Smith. Let me give you a little bit of background on Rod. He is from St. Paul, Minnesota, played his college ball at Notre Dame from 1988 to 1991. He is one of only four true freshmen to letter on the 88 National Championship team. He was a running back in high school, started out as a wide receiver at Notre Dame, then made the switch over to defensive back. He also returned punts and kicks. He was an early second-round pick in 1992 by the New England Patriots, and he was the 35th pick overall. Played there through 1994, and he became the second selection in the 1995 expansion draft by the Carolina Panthers. He played with the Panthers there through 98. He also spent part of that 98 season with the Green Bay Packers. Over the course of his NFL career, he had 251 tackles and 5 interceptions, and we're very excited to have him with us tonight here on Thursday Night Tailgate. Hey, Rod, Chris and Bob here. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, Rod.
Hey, Chris and Bob. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate you guys. Sorry, it's taking so long, but I'm glad to be on.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. Thank you for joining us. And Rod, I want to go back to your time playing at Notre Dame. And I've got to imagine a guy as athletically gifted as you were, you're a very highly recruited guy. So I want to talk about which colleges were after you and how did Lou Holtz end up being the guy to convince you to go to Notre Dame?
This is going to sound like I'm patting myself on the back a bunch, but I think I was somewhere around between 47th and 60th in the country, depending on kind of who you ask. And most kids from Minnesota are not highly recruited in football. We have one or two guys. It's funny how athletics work. I actually caught a huge break. My junior year, there was a kid, Joe Hamburger, remember his name to this day, because I still have never beaten him in the 100-meter dash. And this guy got sick a week before the Minnesota State track meet finals my junior year. So I went ahead and I won the long jump 100 and 200. So all of a sudden, I was a hot commodity because I had a very productive junior year running the football. I had just won the 100, 200, and the big rap about kids from Minnesota is obviously there's no speed there. So after him being sick, me winning those races, all of a sudden, you know, thrust me into the spotlight, and I was a national level recruit all of a sudden. I'll tell you what, had Joe Hamburger, who when he got healthy my senior year, I did not beat him once. Had he run in that race and I got second in all those things, I may have gone to somewhere else. You know what I mean? It certainly would not have been the University of Notre Dame. Like, luck is a big part of it, you know, and most athletes, including myself, have a tough time, you know, looking at the breaks. You know what I mean? It's easy to see the things that went wrong in your career, but the breaks that you got, and that was a huge break that I got. And that allowed me to, you know, and then be an All-American and State Player of the Year, and then I could have gone. It sounds crazy, but I could have gone anywhere. You know, I got my acceptance letter from Harvard and from Stanford hanging up in my room at my dad's house to this day. It ended up being Notre Dame because it's a long answer to a short question, so forgive me. But
that's okay.
Notre Dame became the lead on that. Notre Dame and Stanford really kind of came down to. And I took a look at Harvard too, and actually the Air Force of all places. I wanted it. Here's the thing. When we studied football players, there's a huge article actually in Sports Illustrated my junior year in high school, which detailed the plight of NFL players, and that like 60% of them declared bankruptcy sometime in their life. That's a huge, that whole story. So my dad, you know, got a master's degree. So we're reading this thing and he's a very successful guy. And, you know, we're looking at this and go, listen, there's only a 3% chance that as Minnesota State Player of the Year that you get to training camp. So let's not look at where we go to college in terms of being a pro, because that's a pipe dream. You know, let's focus on getting the best education and the best opportunity to have a successful life. And this football is just a vehicle for that. So looking at it from that lens, you know, back then the SEC was graduating about 50% of its African American football players. You know what I mean? The ACC was maybe about 60%. So scratch all those schools. So Now we're looking at schools that actually graduate their kids and have a high academic pedigree. So you're looking at Stanford, you're looking at Notre Dame, you're looking at Harvard. Well, Harvard's football team at the time was garbage. Stanford's football team was garbage. They had Jack Elway was in his last year coaching. He had already said before the year started that he was going to retire at the end of the year, and they had been awful football 3 or 4 years in a row anyway. So Notre Dame was kind of the lead, and I'll tell you what, I went down to Notre Dame, and there was what they call the Oklahoma drill. And so you've got three defensive linemen and one linebacker and three offensive linemen, one running back, and three defensive linemen and one linebacker. And the linebacker was Michael Stonebreaker. And the defensive linemen were Frank Stams, Jeff Alm, and Boo Williams. The offensive linemen were Tim Grunhart, Dean Brown, and Mike Hill. Everybody I just named was drafted, and all but Michael Stonebreaker, who hurt himself, played 6-7 years plus in the league. They're all badasses, pardon my language. So the intensity in the drill, Coach Holtz was coaching the offense, and Barry Alvarez, that monster stud of a leader of men, is coaching the defense. And Lou Holtz is trying to kick Barry's butt, and Barry's trying to kick Lou's butt. And they are screaming at each other, and the intensity of the drill, and Ricky Waters is on one side, and Michael Stonebreaker is the other linebacker. This drill was so intense. Chris Zorch is one of the linemen, too, filling in. I mean, Barry Alvarez literally has tears in his eyes. He's like, guys, I can't coach a defense if you get pushed off the ball. If they can get 5 yards if they get 3 yards in this short of field, we can't play defense. I can't coach you. I'm gonna lose my job. We can't win like this. Can I count on you guys? Listen, he's got tears in his eyes. His players got tears in his eyes. That's how intense it was in a regular drill. It was the craziest thing I'd ever seen. And when I saw that, I said, yeah. Yeah, I want part of that. That's my style of football. For having speed and a little bit of athleticism, I was a knuckle dragger. I was a grinder. I used to try to beat guys up. I was never great in coverage like Leonard was. You just had on. He was a monster of a football player. I can talk to you about Leonard for an hour. He's a beast. I mean, just one of the toughest guys I've ever played against on special teams. Leonard Wheeler. If you have to block Leonard Wheeler, you are in for a long day. He was a monster, and he never got tired. I mean, his physical fitness was off the charts. I mean, same as like Jerry Rice or Steve Tasker, those guys. Jerry Rice, they never, ever got tired. That's the kind of guy Leonard was, too. But on the football side, I watched that drill at Notre Dame, that intensity, and I said, yeah, I want to be part of that. And the last thing is that Notre Dame gives you 5 years to graduate. That was really attractive to me. So whether you're redshirted or not, I have another year to go back to Notre Dame and study anything I want for a calendar year and stay in the dormitory if I want to. I probably won't take that, but it's available to me. And that just gives you an idea of that university's commitment to the education of their football players. They give you five whether you redshirt or not. So like I said, a long answer to a short question, but that's why I chose University of Notre Dame, because I thought it would give me the best chance to have a successful life. And, by the way, we won the national championship. We had pretty good football, right? But I went there because of the academics.
And speaking of the national championship year, it's almost 31 years ago to the day, October 15th, 1988, you guys played then number one ranked Miami. It was the Catholics versus the Convicts. A game you guys would ultimately win 31-30. But talk about the hype, the buildup of that game, and what it was like being a part of it.
It was crazy. I mean, you know, Jimmy Johnson's coming into town. They're the number one team in the country. I think at the time they had a 36 game winning regular season winning streak, something crazy like that. But we knew we were good. You know, we beat a Michigan team week one, that I think had maybe gone undefeated since us. We beat a Michigan State team with George Perlis and all those guys, Percy Snow, that whole group, Andre Rison, that whole team up there, those studs. We beat them and they had gone undefeated since us. So we knew we were good. We beat some good teams. And the way to cross over was to beat Miami. And they had just beat the dog out of us the year before, 2 years before. What was it, 47-7 or something? They just beat the dog out of us. So we were looking for a little payback. And, so all week long, there was no fear of Miami. We couldn't wait for them to get off the plane. And it was a battle of Titans. That game could have gone anyway. I mean, let's call it what it is. That game could have gone anywhere. But I will say this about that game that was interesting. Kind of inside the lines. It's not talked about enough. The way Jimmy Johnson handled the Miami Hurricane football team on that last drive is about as courageous a thing I have ever seen on a football field, ever. That guy is a man among men. So Miami's driving to tie the game up. They're the number one team in the country. They score on the virtually the last play of the game. Okay? Now, all they have to do is kick a field goal, tie the game, and they stay number one, and they get rings. They get hardware that they'll wear forever. I have my national championship ring in front of me right now, sitting right here. So they could have had one of these. All they had to do is kick a field goal. Done so. Do you know what Jimmy Johnson did? They scored, and I remember looking across the field, and I go, what the hell? Jimmy Johnson is about 15 yards out on the field without his headset. So Miami scores. All the players celebrate. They start jogging off the field. Jimmy Johnson's 15 yards on the field at the 40-yard line with his hands up, both hands up, saying, stay there, stay there. Then he calls the offensive signal and then says, with the like wiggling your finger, like run it, and walks back up the field. Yeah. Listen, Jimmy Johnson was trying to win the game. Forget the tie and the national title and forget the rings. I am playing to beat your tail. I play to win the game every time. All he had to do was kick a field goal to be national champions, and he didn't do it. Not only did he not do it, he was out on the field with the play call, without his headset. That is a Jimmy Johnson decision. He's not asking anybody, hey, coordinator, what do you think about this? What should we run? No, no, no. Jimmy had the play. Here's what it tells you. Just like, I'm kind of jumping around here, just like Belichick did in the Super Bowl against Seattle. When Seattle ran that ball on second down and got it down, on first down, ran that ball down to the 2-yard line, Belichick already had his bigs coming in to run goal line. As soon as the ball hit the ground, the whistle said, boop, the bigs are running in because Belichick is four plays ahead and Jimmy Johnson was four plays ahead. So when they scored the touchdown, he was already ready with the play in his head. He didn't talk to anybody about it. He had his headsets off, and he was on the field. So when they scored, when they turned around, he was so far on the field they couldn't get back to the sideline. I mean, listen, when he called me at the draft, because kind of a long story here, but Jimmy Johnson called me because they moved up. Dallas moved up from, you know, like 37th moved up from like 57th to like 37th in the draft, and he called me. My phone rang in my house. Hey, Rod, it's the phone. It's Jimmy Johnson, Dallas Cowboys. I go, what? Hey, Rod, this is Coach Johnson from Dallas Cowboys. We just moved up in the draft, like 10 spots or 20 spots or whatever, because we're going to take you. I was like, would you like to be a Cowboys, son? Hell yes. I can't wait to play with you, Coach. I said, I got to tell you, the thing you did running on the field was the most courageous thing I've ever seen a football player. He goes, I appreciate that, Rod. Like, we didn't get it done, But I only know one way, and that's play to win. I said, I can't wait to play for this guy. And then New England traded up and picked me. But I was going to be a Cowboy. I was going to play for that man. And when I finally had a chance to talk to him, the first thing I said to him was, I can't tell you how much I appreciate what you did in that game, how courageous that was. I don't know anybody else who would have just said, listen, I'll take the tie and the ring and get out of here. Not Jimmy Johnson.
So you got to take that a step further now, Rod. You're ready to be a Cowboy. They traded up to get you. The Patriots swoop in and pick you. Are you disappointed?
Absolutely. I was crushed. The New England Patriots at the time were, I think they'd gone like 6-10 the year before. They were sagging. My rookie year, we were the worst team in the league. We went 2-14. We were awful. And at the time, New England had had a lot of segregation type, not segregation, but was a very segregated city that had a lot of issues with their basketball players. D. Brown had just had some problems in North Boston. And it just wasn't a place you wanted to go to. It's cold. I'm from Minnesota. I went to Notre Dame. I had enough of that. You know, Dallas just sounds nice, you know? So, and I knew Jimmy Johnson was going to build a monster and win Super Bowls. That's going to happen. So yeah, I was crushed. Now, I turned out to love Boston. I got connected with some of the Boston Red Sox, Tim Nearing and Mo Vaughn and those guys took me under the wing. Was great. I mean, I'm at the Red Sox game and they're sitting in the first row by the behind the dugout and I'm leaving. I mean, I'm a 22-year-old kid. I'm like, this game sucks. And I'd go to Boston Beer Works and have a beer. And I get a call from Mo Vaughn. He's like, I gave you seats in the first row for the Yankees and they're empty. Where are you guys? And we're like, we're at Boston Beer Works where the girls are. Where are you? At the game? Yeah, you guys are down 9-0. We used to get out of there. You know what I mean? Game's over, player. So I mean, that's how silly it was. You know what I mean? He's like, where are you guys? We're like, we're at Boston Beer Works. Where are you? That game was over. So Boston turned out to be, I still love Boston. I mean, I love that town. And how can it not grow on you? I mean, the fans is great.
Yeah.
And then Parcells came in my second year, and then it was off to the races. You know, I mean, I did everything I could to try to stay there. It literally just came down to a money deal where what they could afford at the time and what I could have gotten in the draft were better. And even Bill Parcells himself, here's how cool this guy is. Here's what a good man he is. Even Bill said, "Rod, listen, I know you got a savings goal you want to make," and I did. I want to make the savings goal. He goes, "Listen, I can put you in the expansion draft. You'll be the one of the first players picked, and you'll get a good contract, and you can make your savings goal. If you stay here, I can only offer you X, and you can make almost double that on the market. So, I would be restricting you here. I just the way the money is, it's what I've got left. And as a man, I'm telling you, as a man to man, like I want you. I think you're a good player, but you're gonna be a high pick. And I know it sounds crazy, but this is the best way for you to get your savings goal. You know what I mean? And that's how cool. That's how good he was. I mean, it sounds crazy, but yeah. And so he's like, I'll give you a choice. If you want the contract, you can do it. But like, you'll make double in the market. And I'm just telling you, you know. So I tried it, and I was scared to death. And I won't lie to you, I broke down in tears. I did not want to leave New England. I was a starter. We were just getting good. We'd gone from the worst team in the league in 92 to Bill comes in. We go, I think we were 7-9 that first year. Then next year we go 10-6. And we're getting better. Drew Bledsoe's playing great. Like, I know that team is going to be winning Super Bowl sooner or later. It's coming. Parcells is one of the best coaches to ever walk in two legs. So, it was rough leaving there. I'm glad I came to Charlotte and into the Panthers and was part of that first year. And that second year was amazing playing Dallas and beating Dallas here in the playoffs and playing Green Bay for the NFC Championship was amazing. I still live here. I love this town. But yeah, life is interesting, and that was a moment where I made the right decision coming to Carolina. But at the time, it was pretty painful. I didn't want to leave that team. I was part of that process of it growing, you know, from worse to where they are now, and or not now, but you know, in early '90s and late '90s. But yeah, that's how I went down with Parcells in New England and Jimmy Johnson. Yeah.
Bob, questions for Rod?
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff so far, Rod. I just wanted to revisit Notre Dame for 1 second and ask you about combining the academics and the football. Was it tough for you at first, Rod? Is something that you were totally prepared for or something you have to grow into?
It's something that you have to grow into. I'm very fortunate to have two extraordinarily highly educated people. Mom's got multiple PhDs and dad's masters and all that. So like I grew up in a family where, you know, where listen, if you've got C's, you're not playing anything in our house. I mean, they're listen, if you're less than a 3.0 in anything, you're not playing anything. So, it's just the way we do business. And like a lot of homes, you know what I mean? We're not that unusual, but in our house, it's, you know, if you get a B or higher, then now you can play. If you've got C's, you're not playing anything. So, it's just the way I grew up, and you study hard. It's, you know, it's funny. I think a lot of kids get a bad rap with that because it's environment. You know what I mean? I mean, you know, even a kid that's not super talented, academically, if you tell him, listen, you're going to read an hour every night and you're going to study 2 hours every night and you hold him to that, he's going to be fine. You know what I mean? So I put that one on parents, you know, a lot when the kids don't do well academically. I'm like, if you make it a priority, your kid is going to be okay. I'm not saying a C student is going to go to Harvard, but a C student who works his tail off is going to get B's, you know? So that's kind of how I grew up in. So I went to Notre Dame and academically I was ready to go. I could have gone to Harvard or Stanford or anywhere else. And I was ready to compete academically. I will tell you this, that being said, I'm not a huge church going guy and I'm not an atheist, but the theology class. So in Notre Dame, this is theology at Notre Dame, right? So I go to the bookstore and I get a Bible. I buy a Bible. So I go to class. So I get in class. I'm sitting in class and everybody's got these Bibles that are like handed down from their great, great grandfather. You know, they open it up and there's like dust comes off of it and there's like a seal in blood and gold on it. You know what I mean? And this lady, the girl next to me was like, is that your Bible? I go, yeah. It still had the sticker on it. Yeah, I don't know, 1999 on it or something, right? So then the professor goes, okay, everybody turn to Corinthians 30:46. I was looking for the table of contents, right? So I got my first C. So I got a C at midterm. And here's how they do it in Notre Dame. If you have less than a B in a class at midterm, you are assigned a tutor for 45 minutes for each class. I won't mention any names, but there were some guys that didn't get out of study hall. Study hall started at 7. There were some guys that didn't get out of study hall until 10 o'clock for 3 years. You know, so, and if you miss one, you don't go see the football coach. You go see the president of the university. That whole deal is run by the academic office. Yeah, not by the football office. That's run by the academic office. So their goal is that when the time, I don't care what crummy high school you went to, we don't care about that. What we care about is that you graduate this university as a Notre Dame man, like every Notre Dame man or Notre Dame woman before you and will ever come after you. So whatever crummy high school you went to, we're going to get you in with a tutor one-on-one for every class, and we're going to get you up to speed. And there were guys, I won't mention any names, there are some guys that would not have graduated any other university in the world, in the universe, had they not been in this kind of protocol, this kind of attention to detail. And if you miss one, forget about playing in the game. You got to go see the president of the university, who will tell you, if you miss 2 or 3 more of these, you're out of here. Like, we're not doing this. This isn't like, well, we're going to start, you're not going to start for this game. No, no, no. We will kick you out of this university and send you home. Notre Dame men and women don't act like this. And that includes you. We've got standards here. And so I can tell you, there are guys that would not have graduated anywhere else in the world. And one of them now is an attorney. 2 of them are professors. One of them owns about 5,000 units in Chicago, high-rise buildings. They're all superstars. And they would have been on the street anywhere else. So I can't even put into words how grateful I am for Notre Dame's insistence on making young men into Notre Dame men and women. It was a brutally difficult experience, but you get through it, you know, and then you get the B's, and your grades get higher, and you get better, and it makes for a better life. It's tough when you're going through it, but it's one of the reasons why the Notre Dame fans are so crazy. Notre Dame football players, ex-football players are all crazy. We all go back to games. We all meet in Chicago. I see all my guys. I connect with everybody because the school just has that kind of impression on everybody. It's a life-changing experience for the better. No question.
And Rod, you mentioned having grown up in Minnesota and you mentioned the cold weather. And I often kid with Chris about, I'm in New England here and I tell him how bad it can get. Minnesota takes it to a totally different level. And you growing up there, born there, I often tell people the warm weather people I talk to, it kind of toughens you up to a thing that you really can't explain to people that haven't been through it. But tell us about how cold it can get there and maybe some experiences you had in that.
Yeah, it's nuts, man. I mean, my junior year, we played in a playoff game against St. Thomas, really good school, and And we lost. We scored on the last play of the game, and I had a 2-point conversion. We ran a toss sweep to me, and I almost ran into the back of one of my wide receivers, and they got tackled me about a yard short. I gave it all I had. I guess, you know, one for the bad guys. But that game was, it was, 17 degrees below zero with a 26 mile an hour wind.
Wow.
It was insane. I mean, it literally took about two series just to be able to like focus on football and not focus on how cold we were. I don't know how my parents were in the stands. People were running back and forth to their cars, and I was nuts. It was crazy. So yeah, Minnesota football at the end of the year, if you're in the playoffs, can get pretty dicey before you get into the dome. But yeah, it was crazy. And then going to school, I mean, we had snow drifts, you know, taller than I was. I remember one time coming inside of my dad and just saying, "Dad, the bus isn't here." He goes, "Is the bus here?" I go, "No, the bus isn't here." But I just had a question, like, is there somewhere else we can live? Because the snowbank is taller than I am. Like something. I'm only in sixth grade, but I know that something is wrong with this picture when the bus can't see me because I'm below the snowbank. Like, come on. Like, he's like, "No, we'll be fine." So I asked that question, but I didn't know that. I didn't know that. Yeah, you're up in New England. Listen, like I said, I fell in love with that place. The thing about Boston is that, and I'll tell you this funny story. Andre Tippett, because I had heard all the stories about, you know, Northie and Southie and all this stuff and places you're supposed to go and where you're not supposed to go and all that kind of nonsense. So I said, "Andre Tippett, man, like, you know, listen, I heard about the city and I want to live in Marina Bay. You know, I want to live by the tent and Amelia's was the big hot Italian restaurant there at the time. And everybody else lived down in Foxborough. Like, I want to live in the city." I'm like, "Why would I live in Foxborough? Forget that. Now, I want to live in Boston, not Foxborough." So, It's a you know, it's a 45-minute drive in the morning and an hour back. So what? I mean, I'm a 22-year-old guy living in Boston. I mean, are you kidding me? Like, I want to be close to where the girls are. So I'm in Marina Bay and I said, "I'm a tip, like, you know, how do I manage this? Like, give me some advice. You know, you live in this town for a long time." He goes, "Listen, here's what you do. Here's what you do." He goes, "Where are you gonna live? Marina Bay, North Quincy?" He goes, "All right, listen. Find the police chief in North Quincy and you tell him that your uncle's a statey. And you want to donate tickets to the police benevolent fund. And anytime they want to go to a game, that they call you if they need two tickets for any football game, and you're going to take care of them. You do that. All right. You just do that and stay close to the police." I said, "All right." So I called him up, made the appointment, gave him two tickets. "Hey, these are two tickets. You know, anytime you guys need tickets, let me know. And just let me know you need tickets. I got two for you. You know, I'll take care of you guys. Like, you know, happy to be part of the community here, new into Boston." And, listen, I got connected with the police, man. And listen, I mean, nothing, I'm not Whitey Bulger, don't get me wrong, but I mean, like, but you couldn't get a speeding ticket and you could just be out later, like, just less bad things happened to me than probably could have. I'll say it that way. I mean, they just look out for you. They look out for you. I mean, one time I was late getting to the stadium for a game, like an actual game. Like, I'm trying to get to the stadium in the traffic area, and the cop saw me, was like, "Rod, hey, Smitty, hey, man, get behind me." And listen, he got in the side of the highway and in the breakdown lane, and we took off. I was like, so I got there on time. Like, that kind of thing doesn't happen to you. Boston is a, as far as I'm concerned, right, you know, is a relationship town. You know what I mean? Like, if you go to the same restaurant and you get to know the owner and you tip well, you get to know him, and you shake his hand, you get to know him, you'll get better service. You'll get better treatment. You'll get first in line. But if you don't know anybody in Boston, you're just walking around like, you know, just being mean to people, you're going to have a little tough time. But if you're nice to people and you meet people and you get to know them and form a relationship with them, Boston will open up to you just for anything you want to do. It's just an amazing town, but it's relationship driven. It's not transactional. It's relationship driven. And that advice I got from Andre Tippett was invaluable.
Rod, just a couple more before we let you go. And I know you've got a wonderful business now, Magnolia Cabinetry, which looks like you make some outstanding looking cabinets for homes. Talk about what you're doing now.
Yeah. I'm working with Magnolia Cabinetry, and we We installed, we provided install cabinets for multifamily developers, primarily. I take on some single family builders in the Charlotte area. We're primarily multifamily. You know, we started a new construction division 3 years ago, which I run, which has been gangbusters for us. But a primary business is actually multifamily rehab. Companies that go out and buy multifamily units, and then rehab those. That's what we do. We provide the cabinets and sometimes the countertops and faucets and sinks and all the other kind of mission critical items. But it's been a great business, and anybody can go to magnoliacabinetry.com and look me up or call the office and mention my name and it'll get back to me and I'll make sure you get taken care of. So including you guys, if you guys are ever remodeling your kitchen or bathroom or something like that, before you buy anything, call me. At least find out. Let me see what you're looking at and let me make sure you get the right price. And then whether you work with us or not, I'd be happy to help you. Just make sure that you get the right product. So yeah, like I'm a Chris and Bobby, I'm on your side. So anything like that comes up for you guys, you reach out to me.
Appreciate
that. Wow. I appreciate that very much, Rod. Let our listeners know, how can they stay up to date with all the great things that you're doing on social media?
It's funny. I've got to get dialed in with it. I'm on Facebook, but I'm going to open an Instagram account here in the next week or two. I've got a marketing person in our office, a new one that's going to get me up to speed on that. But my LinkedIn page is up. Rod Smith, you can go there and get updates on what's happening with the business and some personal insights as well that are going on. And LinkedIn is probably the best way to reach me. But you can look me up on LinkedIn and IndieGrad22@gmail.com is my email address if you want to reach out to me. Just reach out or magnoliacabinetry.com in search for the business side of things. But happy to help anybody, any of your listeners that need help with cabinets.
Well, Rod, we can't thank you enough for taking time out of your night to come and be a part of the show. You're fantastic. We hope you'll come back and do it again sometime.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sorry for the long-winded answers,
loved it. You kidding me?
Yes, a good deep questions. You know what I mean? That you have to flesh it out. So I appreciate you guys being patient with me as well, man. And like I said, that guy Leonard Wheeler you had on was an absolute animal, and not just in incredible shape, never got tired, and relentless and strong and fast and a good athlete. But a guy that really studied the game too. Leonard's wildly intelligent. You guys talked about all the time, so you know this. But if you're not thinking about what's supposed to happen on the play, Leonard will beat you. Just on that alone. If you're not sure where you're going to take your first step, he certainly is. So I have so much respect for him, and he's a dear friend, and I love playing against him. Playing against Leonard Wheeler for 3 hours will make you a better man. I'm telling you, like he will challenge you mentally and physically and emotionally, because he's gonna find out where your breaking point is with his conditioning. And it was always a real challenge to play against him, and a thrill too. Just really one of the highlights of my career was facing against guys like him and Steve Tasker for the Bills. Like, playing against those guys changes your character for the better, no question.
Well, Rod, take care. Thank you again for being a part of the show tonight. We'll catch up with you again real soon. In between now and then, all the best to you and your family, my friend.
Thanks, Rod.
And to you guys, man. Take care. Thank you both.
Good night.
See you, Rod. That's Rod Smith and Bob. Unbelievable segment there. Great stories, all the detail, the things that he got to be a part of, the stuff with Jimmy Johnson, outstanding. Boy, I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, great storyteller, Chris. And you're right, we just touched the surface, and I can see us having him on multi times in the future. This is he's a friend of Leonard. He's definitely a friend of ours now. But yeah, that's the kind of guy you like. Just come up with some good questions, and he gives us a lot of information. That was great.
Yeah, no, and that's, you know, no need for him to talk about long-winded answers. I mean, my goodness,
no.
You know, our job is to give you a question and let you run, and that was fantastic. Listen, and next time, not only did he play with Leonard Wheeler, but he also played with our good friend Devon McDonald there at Notre Dame, so hopefully we'll get an opportunity to hear about that, but really looking forward to getting him back on the show.
Excellent.
All right, Bob and I will come back, and when we do, we'll be turning on our Thursday night tailgate spotlight on the positive here. Two more stories about players doing great things out there in their communities. We'll do that right on the other side of this real quick station break.